Incredible stuff. Now there's more. By day, John Levin is president of Barrington Media, a producer of digital marketing media specializing in high-tech and healthcare. But most of us know John as a premier collector of early commercial cylinder recordings. Dan Reed has a day job too, as a professional music educator supporting the curriculum of 75 teachers in a large urban school district. We know Dan through his research, publications, and lectures about bands from the Golden Age, and he considers the Golden Age to be 1861 to 1932. Don't tell Benny Goodman that. Today, Dan and John are going to focus on a true piece of cylinder incunabula, a recording made by the Edison Phonograph Works in 1891. We all sometimes wonder what these early recording sessions really sounded like, and I'm wondering, John and Dan, if you could get us all one step closer.
For a brief part of this, you guys might want to actually, those people sitting on the outside might want to actually come in a little bit, because this is about stereo. While you're doing that, I have a commercial message. You are in Tinseltown, and this is what's called product placement. Dan Reed and I are here thanks to the California Antique Phonograph Society. And were it not for that organization, we would not know each other. We would not know of our shared fondness for this early music. And in fact, we would not have done this project at all. So we're kind of a metaphor for what the organization is all about. It's full of enthusiasts interested in early recordings and the technology to reproduce them. It's a very collaborative organization with a lot of friendship and also a lot of accretion of knowledge through the sound box, which some of you may know of, and just through other activities we're involved in. We are trying to build on the historical record. If you want to know more about the organization, there's a sheet up here. So having said that, on with the show.
Okay. Before we get started, I just want to know, is the person who burned the word stereo on my front lawn with a cross through it using brown wax recordings, is that person here? I knew it. Okay, I got a bone to pick with you. No. On with the show. There is some mystery about how early cylinder recordings were produced. By early, I mean prior to the development of molding at the turn of the century. Based on anecdotal and fragmentary information, the common belief is that a group of machines recorded a round, and that these cylinders were used as masters to produce dubs acoustically in the early years, 1889, 1890, and then pantographically thereafter. Knowing this, collectors of early commercial recordings have always had this what-if bug. What if you found two recordings from this early period and from the same take? Since each horn collected differing versions of the sound, wouldn't it stand to reason that once transferred and lined up, you would, in essence, have a primitive, unintentional, and incredibly early stereo recording? The thought was intriguing, but with most early cylinders lost forever, the likelihood of finding two cylinders that are identifiably from the same take was extremely slim. The perfect subjects for this project appeared last year. Collectors and archivists of this early era, many of you, have experienced the huge sense of loss when leafing through page after page of early phonograph catalogs filled with artists and titles we have never seen or heard. So it was miraculous that two copies of this early rarity in decent condition appeared. These cylinders were both recorded on April 30th, 1891 at Orange, New Jersey. This was the 18th of 23 selections recorded that day. Cujus Animum, the title means Whose Soul, on a melody by Rossini, is a cornet solo by David B. Dana with piano accompaniment by the ubiquitous Edward Isler. And it's one of the finest and rarest performances of this cornet solo captured during this time period.
Now, as many of you know, this early period is filled with conundrums, inside of mysteries, and we're constantly trying to understand more about it. The fact that this is the 18th selection gives us no sense of how many times the 18th selection was recorded, how many rounds were there, or anything about it. So immediately there was a question, were these cylinders in fact related to each other in any direct way? But once we heard the announcement, it became clear that they were. We might have to kick up the sound a little bit on this. So, for those of you who've done work in film sound, you know that you always look for a sync pop, and that cough was the sync pop that we all wanted as a starting point, and it's certainly an identification that these two cylinders were the same. I have a few more things to say about this announcement before we go on, so let me just play it once again. There are a few things that we should just talk about briefly. The fact is, if you notice, the guy is speaking in an absolutely normal voice. He's not shouting. He's probably standing quite close to the horns, very much like the violinist in the photograph you can see on the screen. And as a result, he actually needs to refer to his notes to find out who's playing, which is why there's a little pause. And then the most interesting part to me is the fact that at the end he says duplicate. And in fact, we don't exactly know what that means, because some of these cylinders from this period have it and some don't. So with that, it was time to move on and to start doing what we were supposed to do. Really, there's a two-part process, transferring and compositing this. And our goal through the process was to basically, with this minimal amount of funny stuff, to basically put these two recordings together to see what there was. And when I say funny stuff, what I mean is, if any of you have ever fooled around EQing mono material, you know that it's actually not very hard to produce stereo-like effects with just selective EQing and sort of messing around. And of course, there were a lot of mastering engineers who made a living doing this about 45 years ago. They called it reprocessed for stereo. So we certainly didn't want to do that, our goal was to avoid that. So first step was to go to UCSB, where Professor Soibert and his team, including Alberto Solis, who you can see here, basically transferred the material for us. And this is basically their audio chain, very straightforward. And then it basically came down to the compositing part of it. And we basically used, you know, very simple available tools. We used the new version of Diamond Cut software. And one of the cylinders was considerably noisier than the other. So we used continuous noise filtering on both, but you did it separately. And in applying it, we were very concerned about actually reducing or eliminating any part of the program material. So the result is a fairly noisy, two fairly noisy recordings, but again, we didn't want to get even close to the program material in doing that noise reduction. When we lined up the two files, basically, one was 0.38 seconds longer than the other, which is actually pretty darn close when you think that these were played on two separate machines. What that comes down to is a speed, assuming that the archaeophone was a constant, that would mean a 0.3% speed difference between the two mastering machines, or over the roughly 300 revolutions, about a half revolution difference, giving you a sense of the kind of attention they were paying to, recording at that time. Anyway, so one file was squished to match the other, and then we combined them, and we provided some we applied some pretty standard EQ settings for cylinders of this period, kind of, you know, kicking them up broadly at 360 and also sort of, you know, peaking them up at 2470, and then normalize them, and that was it.
Well, it was now time. It was either going to be aha or oh shit. So we want to play a couple of things for you. Here's a segment of the recording in mono, and we'd like you to listen carefully to how, in typical mono fashion, the instruments are kind of all piled up on top of one another.
Again, this is mono.
Performance by that guy. It just blows me away every time I hear it. John and I were talking about it. We could listen to it over and over a million times. Now I'd like to play segment from the composited file. I'd like you to listen for the spread and separation. Now note that the combined noise characteristics make this version a little noisier. One of the things that I love about audio is that it immediately takes you into a land of ambiguity and an area that's really often more qualitative than quantitative. I'm sure you heard the spread, and there is some separation of instruments there. But is it stereo? In fact, are these two different recordings? I've listened to this a few times. I listened to it with headphones. I listened to it with magnapans that are very good for imaging. And I actually think that it's inconclusive. But we'll come back to that later. First, let's talk about the stereo part of this. It is said, probably apocryphally, that when Rudolf Diesel built his first prototype, which blew up, destroyed a barn, and almost killed him, that day he made an entry in his diary, which you can see on the screen. And indeed, I think that probably the reason why you're all here is because you wanted to hear a stereo recording from 1891. And in the process of this project, the reality of the problem emerged. So, Stereo reproduction refers to an illusion of directionality and perspective that is created sonically. The goal here is to create a facsimile of an actual performance, regardless of whether that performance ever took place. The way stereo works, of course, is by using two or more sound sources to create a stage where subtle differences in amplitude and phase relationship place each part of the program material. Our ears, actually our brain, is really good at discriminating these differences, as evidenced by our awareness of where sounds emanate from, even sounds in a noisy room, or sounds coming up behind us.
So we're gonna ease into this. Let's go back to this image you saw before. Let's assume that instead of there being a violinist, that that's David B. Dana, and maybe he's standing a little farther back so as not to blast. If you imagine that the two machines that are on the top shelf each have a cylinder that we were transferring, the machine on the left would get more information from the piano on the right because on axis. The piano or the machine on the right is off axis and therefore would pick up less of the piano. In other words, if those two cylinders were transferred in some sort of a stereo way, the sound stage would in fact be flipped. I think you can sort of see where this is going, because of course horn arrangements were not based on stereo, they were based on just trying to pick up whatever they were trying to pick up. By the way, this is a photo from 1900. But that's just the beginning. Of course, the machines were being driven independently, and so the only constant you have in this is the actual performance. And as Dan was saying, one of the important aspects of stereo is the very subtle phase differences that happen when you're on your sound stage, which you're trying to capture. The ear is incredibly good at differentiating these things, which is why we will know where a sound is coming from even when it's behind us. So since these machines weren't ganged, that information was completely lost. The one thing we do have is amplitude information, that would be based on placement, not necessarily the right placement, but it would be there, and that's part of what would contribute to some sort of a stereo effect. And by the way, footnote, this is George W. Johnson who's making this recording. So that's where we are.
So we want to know, was this project a waste of time, a monumental boondoggle that we went into? Well, we think not. There's some obvious takeaways. Nothing synchronizes. Phase information is lost. And at best, synthesis, stereo, but not stereo. The word duplicates that's used are, well, we're really still not sure. It could mean duplicates from two different machines. It could mean duplicates of the same recording. Not sure yet. But the biggest takeaway is we all got a little closer to 1891.
And I think there's another point that we want to make here, and that is that this really couldn't have been done 10, 15 years ago. And in fact, what we did today was mostly done with a $200 piece of software. So I think that it's quite likely that with the next generation of restorers and with proper preservation of these recordings, there's a lot to be learned. Certainly more sensitive capture technology, we hope, is on the horizon. Processing is getting more granular all the time. The ability to make subtle adjustments in speed deviation to actually lock recordings based on that is also out there. And you know, time delay spectrometry will help us pick up background information that's now generally lost. So I think it's for the next generation of restorers to fully answer these questions, but it's been fascinating getting as far as we have. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you actually lay them one on top of each other.
No, out of phase. That's the standard that you use when you're comparing two stereo tracks. If you put them, or two mono tracks. If you take one of them and put it out of phase, put it into mono, whatever is different in the two tracks would be heard. But whatever is the same in the two tracks will disappear.
The problem is that you are used to stereo. You're thinking like a person who listens to stereo, where you assume that everything is essentially on the same time base throughout. These recordings are basically, if you think of it as basically two aligned waveforms like this, they're constantly doing this. So if you lay them on top of each other, they're always out of phase. They're shifting constantly because the machines are. It's not just a matter of squishing one so it lines up. Across the entire timeline, these things are shifting against each other.
Well, a comparison can be made with comparing these two cylinders those ways. And two cylinders or two discs that you know are absolutely identical. And whether there's any difference in what happens when you combine two identical recordings out of phase that you play on two separate machines and these two recordings. You might be able to see whether that's something which would always happen, whether these are, that they should, this shows more differences than two recordings that you know are.
It's true, although, it's, our guess is that if in fact, that there were probably multiple machines taking the recording, they produce masters that were then, and subs came off of that, which is what we have. So then the slaves would also have differences. But I see where you're going with it, and it's an interesting thing. But to basically answer, if you take the recording that we created, the composite, and you mono it, it's very swishy, and it's swishing all the time. Any other questions? Yeah. I'm sorry? Well, what I'm saying is that because you do not have two, because you're not basically recording in a two-track format, because you're not having, at this point, where you've got recordings that are moving at different speeds, you can't line them up. Yeah. The arrangement is unclear and it probably varied from one session to another based on what was being recorded. I mean, there you saw a picture of a duet. This is a duet. It would certainly be wonderful if we could find two cylinders, two recordings from this era of a band where they probably had a row of machines. Right. But you're still going to have the issue of two masters that are rotating at different speeds.
John and Dan will be here. You can ask them questions. We need to move on, but I thought that was fascinating, if inconclusive, presentation. Thanks a lot.